Got a bad bitch on me.
What?
Got a bad bitch on me. She
D T F. She tell me she
D T F.
I heard she
D T F.
What?
And you ain't hanging with the team if you ain't down to fuck.
Okay. Well,
hello and welcome to DTF, the Daryl Timmery Fun Hour, the greatest sex education, comedy, sometimes game show podcast in the known universe. Hi, I'm your resident sexuality educator, Dr. Timmery.
And I'm Daryl Charles.
Yay. And we've been doing this for seven years? What did we do? We've been doing this for a while.
Five, yeah. 11? It's been a while.
This is the opening of Mr. and Mrs. Smith, where it's like, how long have you been together? Yeah. So we're going to be talking about sexuality that's in the news. And today, one of those pieces will actually be just us doing a sort of book report on we don't read books. We just watch movies.
So we're going to
talk about some news. We do read books. That's true.
I just bought an audiobook. I've been doing that more frequently than reading.
Yeah?
Yeah. So the one I'm listening to right now is Cack Handed, a memoir by Gina Yashiri.
Ooh. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. I'm currently reading this book called Bottoms Up, and it's like a pathologist's essays on a bunch of weird things in art history. So there'll be like an entire chapter on like depictions of spanking young boys in like medieval art and then in later centuries. And right now it's all on like the depictions of lepers. And it's just stuff for like, I don't know anything about this. This is wild. And I learned so many like big words that I'm like Googling as I read it.
What's the most recent big word?
I think there was one that I wanted to remember. I think it was like I'm gonna look it up so that I pronounce it correctly. It was concupiscence.
Concupiscence,
which noun. Is strong sexual desire or lust. And I was like, I gotta remember that.
Ooh, concupiscence. Trying to concoop that.
I also learned redoubtable, which I think I actually learned in high school and forgot.
I read out. All I know is that there are a number of caves in Skyrim that are called the something something readout. So I imagine it has to do with a role-playing game that's 10 years old.
Well, when I looked it up, it said it was kind of like formidable. Like someone's like a big significant presence. I also learned dipsomania, which has to do with alcoholism and specifically a form where you have intermittent bouts of cravings.
Called life.
Yeah. I also learned pruritic, which I think was just like a type of very itchy. Because I was on the lepers chapter. Yeah. So sure. That's fun and light and definitely related to fucking.
Hell yeah. Putting new information in our brains. Yeah. And we all know that the most sex happens between your ears.
Well, it's true.
So, yeah. Every orgasm is because of what? Dopamine or something? Serotonin? Something?
Well, yeah, when you have a paroxysm, the first part of it's the physiological like release of the muscle tension, and then depending on what your parts are, you might have other stuff come shooting out or not. And then there's a lot of different chemicals that flood the brain afterwards, and it also will depend again on like what kind of parts you have, if it's vasopressin, oxytocin. You got a mixture. Serotonin and dopamine are usually connected to like these pleasant things too. So
Yeah, see?
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. Sound good. I have no further notes.
Yeah. So yeah, basically being attracted to someone and spending time with them and those sort of things is to your brain the same as doing a bunch of drugs.
It makes total sense, right? That's why people get really obsessed when they meet a person that they really like, and then the friends who got that oxytocin release from being with them get upset because they found a new drug, and instead of hanging out and watching movies on Wednesday, they're getting drunk and getting their back blown out. And you know, it's all a part of life. We all have to recognize that individuals cannot be responsible for another individual's happiness, and you got to get it from a bunch of different places. And yeah,
there was a phenomenal, I this is like the second time in a row where I've been like, you gotta listen to this podcast, but it's an episode of Hidden Brain that's about marriage, and we talked about that on a recent episode, another podcast that was on marriage, but I've listened to it since we recorded, and I highly recommend it. Shankar Vedantam is also the most fun name to say in the whole world. It's just,
it seems
so beautiful,
like a delight.
And yeah, the whole episode's on like the history of marriage, and I'm like already familiar with that content. Sure. But it was just done so incredibly well, and they talk about the ways that, like, where one person would have previously had a bunch of their needs met by like five different friends, they like would then turn to one person to fill all those needs, and then are like, why isn't this working and why is this difficult, and also just the idea that, like, you know, you can have actually a super super solid, very intimate romantic relationship with a person for a long time. It's just also a shitload of work, and you're gonna have to, you know, sacrifice from other stuff if you want to devote energy to something. That's basically like the big takeaway. But yeah, yeah, Hidden Brain, recent episode on marriage. I recommend it to anybody who's like seriously considering commitments, or I talked to a friend who's like moving in with someone, and I was like, listen to this.
Yeah, yo, you know, that's an in a previous recording we were talking about making people do counseling before getting married, but you know, you should probably do a little bit of that counseling before you get a roommate. Yeah, those living situations, just because y'all don't keep the bathroom door open don't mean that y'all aren't in a relationship. Yeah, and shit can get, ooh man, I mean, the worst roommate situation I had was with dudes, but there was one roommate situation where I was the only guy, and turned out pretty well. Like, I'm still friends with at least one of the people, you know, like
that's an okay track record.
Yeah, it's a good track record, you know. And I have no problems with the other the dudes I was with, except I'll never look at them the same again because of how dirty the place was. And I am not a clean freak, but I have come to learn mess I'm okay with, dirt I am not. It can be messy, but if it's dirty, I could be in a place full of stacks of unkempt paper, as long as it's, there's no dust or bugs.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, I couldn't be in a place that's barren but filthy. I wouldn't be happy.
You have said several times that, like, every marriage is the same, and I've had so many conversations last week where it's like, there's the one partner who cleans when they're anxious, and then the other partner who's like, if you move my stuff, I'll never find anything ever again. Like,
yeah. Yeah.
And I've had that exact same conversation with so many people this week.
Yeah. I can't find my thing. You never look for anything. Well, that's called a relationship. And that is how they all work out.
Yep, they're all the same. All right, so shall we get to our first regular segment?
Yeah, let's do some fucking news.
News. All right, so our first piece of fucking news is an interesting study that I think will just confirm whatever it is the fuck you already believe.
Those are the best studies, always well-renowned. What you think is correct. That's got to be an Onion headline. Study shows... what you think about people has been right this whole time.
Whole time. Absolutely no need to change your viewpoint. Which is an ironic thing.
No new information needed.
Yeah, which is an ironic thing given the study, actually. So mm-hmm. this is a study that was published in Scientific Reports. And it was a study that I think might have taken place in Australia. I can't remember where it was. But all of the studies... that are done generally are done on college students, and this one is like that. So there's a couple hundred university students, and a little over half of them are female identified, and it was basically all people who are self-described as heterosexual, and then they learned about either nothing, like as the control group, or they learned about the idea that sexual orientation is fluid or a spectrum, Like, basically, they probably just learned about, like, the Kinsey scale and just the concept of people being sexually fluid and there being a lot of scientific research and theory about sexual orientation not being just exclusively heterosexual or homosexual.
And then at the... Wait, can we just say scientific theory means that studies were done, things were calculated, and based off those calculations, someone came to a conclusion. Sadly, I shouldn't have interrupted, but we're in 2021, and I just had to roll my eyes when I saw, like, at Johns Hopkins, it was like a poster screensaver or something that was like, here we believe science is real. And I'm like, if we have to make that argument, we've lost already, right? But anyway, yeah, just because, like, I could have a theory that the sun is really the moon, and that's not scientific because it's not based on anything. You can have a theory, you know, anybody can have a theory, it's just an opinion, but a scientific one usually comes with the scientific method and actual rigor. That's all I wanted to say.
And, like, is based on evidence. It's not just conjecture. The term theory in this context is different than, I have a theory that someone in this house doesn't know how to flush.
Question, more of a comment. Why do you hate men? Like, that is a theory. The evidence would be that I'm still friends with that one female roommate.
So in this particular study, everybody, again, that was a participant is self-described as a heterosexual. And at the end of their intervention, this educational intervention, if they were in the control group where they didn't learn about the spectrum idea of sexual orientation, they still, everything was generally pretty much the same. But if they listened to this theory of sexual orientation being more on a spectrum, there was a likelihood, there was a possibility that afterwards they would say, you know what, actually, maybe I'm not entirely straight. Right. And if given the opportunity to hook up with someone of the same sex, you know, I might actually be more open to it than I thought I was. And this is a thing that is unsurprising to hear because I've been looking at the survey data for the last several decades on, like, what percentage of the population identifies exclusively as heterosexual or homosexual. And the population that's, like, 18 to 34, like, the percentage of them who identify as straight has just gone down every year. It's like the same people. We're talking about the same people. It's not just that younger people are more likely to identify as queer now than in the past, but also the same group of people.
As they age.
As time has passed, are more likely to be like, you know what, actually. And at this point, among 18 to 34 year olds, it's only a slight majority. So it's like a little bit, I think it's like 55% who are like exclusively heterosexual.
That is something.
It is so something, because if you ask old people, they're like, mm-mm.
No, we burned them. I ain't one of them. You don't want to know what we did to them when we were little. So I'm definitely not one. And that's usually, I think that is, here's my theory. I think that that's usually a part of their staunch allegiance to the binary, right? Because it's hard to not, when you treat people like outsiders and then you do what Americans typically do to outsiders, you definitely make sure that people want to be on the inside. And so, you know, you could be 55 and be like, I have never, because what do you think when you think about being gay? Oh yeah, getting hit, getting beat up in the locker room, you know, random shit like that. And it's like, yeah, you have entirely negative associations to the outcomes of those people being around. So you would not even want to lend an idea to living that life.
And, like, in addition to the, you know, the fact that older folks grew up with a much more entrenched version of homophobia and much more institutional support for homophobia, aside from that, they're also just more likely to hold these sort of binary beliefs that, like, you're either gay or you're straight. And the population at large is now sort of roughly split on whether sex is binary or whether sex is more of a spectrum. And when I'm saying, like, sexual orientation, I should say, because it's a whole other conversation if we're talking about the idea of biological sex or gender, what we're talking about is whether or not your sexual orientation is like a thing that you were just born with and you were either this team or this team, or if you're like, this can change over time and it's like got nuances and lots of gray spaces to it. Like the society at large, according to like YouGov polling now, basically split down the middle. But if you look at older populations, again, they're much more likely to say like it's an innate thing, it doesn't change. And then younger folks are more likely to be like, what are labels even for? You know, so.
Right. Yeah, it's a, and I feel like the moment I was told about the spectrum thing, I was like, yeah, that makes perfect sense. Like, why does there need to be labels? But it took a while before, I guess, more reading, more enlightening myself, I was like, oh well, people, it's not there's a scale and then boom, you're born and you're a three and that's it. It's like, you know, it depends on all of the circumstances. Like, you know, is it hot outside, somebody wearing a net shirt, have you seen Fight Club, you know what I mean? Like, it's a bunch of different things that can you know, sway you. You could be like, yeah, you know, how about this one? Everybody I know who I've asked, who is married, if you were not married, would you do it again? They usually go no. And that, I think that's because that's the experiential part, right? Everyone, before they get married, that's what you're supposed to do. Everything in the culture says you find someone, you fall in love, you do this stuff, and then you do that. And then you realize what it is to live with another motherfucker. And then everybody's in the same relationship. And then when they get out of that, you get asked, would you do it again? And people go, well, if I had a choice, the answer is a bit different, right? And I think it's a similar thing. And I'm glad that this is happening more and more, that more people are getting differing points of view. They're getting a more broader analysis of life that's allowing them to make a wider bevy of choices. But I do think it's something. I mean, I guess you were saying no matter what, if you were born in a certain time, it's going to be that way. But it's like asking college students these questions. I mean, college, that's the time when you are just whatever flies, typically.
Well, hopefully. But there, you know, there is a division here because, like, even among young people, they're like conservative labeled folks, like that is how they would identify. So that was another thing that they broke this group of participants down into is, are you self-described like progressive politics, independent, conservative, etc.? And the conservative folks, the people who answered that way, regardless of what condition they were in, were unlikely to say that this information changed them. If you came into the study as a self-described conservative, you can learn about this spectrum idea. You can hear what science has done around what do we know about sexual orientation? What is the origin of it? Like, how does it develop over a person? They hear that information, does not change their mind. If someone is identified as more independent or progressive, they were the only ones who were likely to be like, actually, okay, so maybe I'm not exclusively straight. And again, these are all people who came in identifying as straight. None of them through the process of this are like, oh, I'm actually bi.
Right.
Or no, I'm actually gay. That's not what happened. What happened was they were like, okay, so maybe I'm not exclusively straight. So right. The Kinsey scale, for anybody who's not familiar, is literally just a statement of behavior. So Alfred Kinsey was a biologist in Indiana, and he went around and he just surveyed people, just a lot of people, asked him a lot of weird questions. He did a lot of stuff, but the Kinsey scale is based on the idea of what sex have you specifically had, and your partners, what was their sex compared to yours? With the same sex, with different sex? And then over the course of your lifespan, you would fall somewhere on this spectrum if all of your partners were the same sex as you, if all of your partners were a different sex than you, if your partners varied, right? And if you were exclusively engaging in sex with people of the same gender, you're going to be a Kinsey 6. If you exclusively engage in sex with people of a different gender, you're a Kinsey 0. And what he discovered and blew people's minds in the 1950s when he released the human behavior of the sexual male is that statistically, we fall around like a 1 or 2, like somewhere in there. And now if you were to redo it, it would be probably a little further along the spectrum. But it's just asking behavior. It's not asking about what you're interested in. It's not asking about who you love. It's not asking about what if the world were different, what would you do? You know, it's right. not that. And so hearing this information just about the idea of the possibility can open minds if you're not ideologically opposed to learning.
Right. Or, yeah, or if you're not ideologically exposed to, if you just don't like having, if you like having fun. Because I can totally imagine if you lived in a world where you didn't think that that shit was taking place, and then you find out, wait, what? So you mean there's some dudes who just, and nobody told me? Like, I could just imagine, hey, hold on, where were these parties? Behind my house? Behind it? Behind my house, really? Wow, I thought I knew my neighbors. They're like, oh, are you upset that they're like that? No, I'm upset that they didn't invite me. I would have loved the opportunity to say no. Or yes. Mm-hmm. Or more. Mm-hmm. Or both. Could I give a no with a nodding wink? I don't know. Look, the thing is, no one asked me. Mm. And do I stink? Am I just not fun to be around?
No. Oh.
And what we're learning is, yes, you're just not fun to be around. That's why people aren't coming to you with that kind of stuff. If you were nicer or a better person, you would have a wider variety of people around you.
Wow. Okay, hot take. You know, this is funny. This is like a sort of a 90-degree turn, but it kind of reminds me of when I've had those conversations with guys who were like, well, I don't believe that the sexual assault rate's that high because I don't know anybody who's been sexually assaulted. And I'm like, you do. You right. have proven to be a person that they can't talk to.
Can't trust. Yep.
Yeah. Congratulations. You just identified yourself as someone that people do not talk to about that.
How about that? Yep. How yeah. about that? Like, yeah. I mean, yeah, as a young man, I've told this story often, but I was talking to a friend of mine, and she was talking about, you know, everybody college age, those are your clubbing years. Going to the club and dancing with a dude, and when she turned, dancing back to front, and when she turned around, his full erect penis was out on the dance floor, and I was flabbergasted by this. And she was like, Daryl, it happens more times than you think. And I said, get the fuck out of here. And then the next time I spoke to women, any woman, I would go, hey, crazy story. And I would explain that to them, and they all were like, Daryl, are you sure it wasn't me that told you that story? Because it happened to me yesterday, and it's gonna happen to me tomorrow. This is what men do. And I, you know, still, I mean, at first, flabbergasted. Secondly, dismayed that the bar is so low. And then thirdly, a little disappointed in myself that I had never given that a shot. I didn't even know that that was on the table. I didn't even know that that was on the table. I think that, you know, I'm not saying that I have the best penis in the world, but I think, you know, it's worth a gander. And I had never, obviously that's a joke, but like, even as a teenager, like the idea of getting erect, and mind you, you know, I was a teenager in the 90s. This is grinding time. Like, that was the only way you danced.
That's
was
facts. Yeah.
The only way to dance was how it was described in Too Close by Next. Yes. It was the only way one danced.
Yes.
And we did that in junior high school dances. Mm-hmm. We did that. If I wasn't in a mosh pit dancing to Onyx, I was grinding on someone. Mm-hmm. And the entire time, sweating, because I was like, Daryl, if you get an erection, they're going to turn the lights on and cut the music off. They're all going to look at you and go, ill. And so I just learned to disassociate and be worried on rhythm. I was worried about rhythm. I was on the twos every time so that I could keep that monster at bay. And then I find out that these motherfuckers have been releasing the Kraken all over the United States of America. I'm disgusted.
You know, I wish that, like, every dude had to just be the, like, gatekeeper for an email account. I don't know, like, the DMs.
Right.
Of, like, a fictional woman or something for, like, a week or two. Just, like, spend a week. You have to run this email account. You have to run the DMs for this Instagram account. And just see. Like, today, I've got some that I just sort of, like, I have them muted, but you can still see that they're, like, sending messages or whatever. Sure. And it's just, like, the stick-to-itiveness, I guess I could respect just having something you really stick to, but other than that, I don't respect it because it's like...
It's psychopathy.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's and then everybody will always say, like, well, it must work enough that it's worth it, right? Like, if you try it on 100 girls, one of them must fall for it. I'm like, I don't think that's even true.
My uncle told me that as a child. My uncle told me that as a teenager. He's like, you talking to girls? So I was like, well, you know, I have some friends. He was like, oh, don't be no punk. He was like, you just got to try. He was like, listen, you go to a place and you ask 20 girls to go out with you. You only need one, so just keep asking. And I was like, I don't think that that is the way it works. I don't think so. I don't think I think I'm looking for something too. I think I think that's what's happening as well. I'm also selecting. I'm not selecting. I'm just to be selected. Is that this?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think a lot of times people do. I mean, we see it in the culture. That's why women are told to be chased, but men are told to go and chase down women. That's that's it's the shitty part.
The implication there is basically that no one has any redeeming personality features whatsoever, right? Because, like, you as a dude, therefore, are not necessarily supposed to be charming or interesting and win anybody over by your intellect, your kindness, or your creativity, or whatever.
I mean, you can, but you just pull a dick out, you cut to the chase.
And as a woman in that scenario, assuming those are the only two options, of course, like, mm-hmm. the woman, it's like you're basically just interchangeable because they're just doing a numbers game, and there's absolutely nothing about this that you can do that will influence the outcome,
right.
And they're wildly disinterested in your level of participation in this conversation. So it's like, it's more like you're a vending machine, and they just keep hoping that if they put in enough coins...
Right, and if you like coins, then you will pass out the candy, I guess. It's just the way that it's supposed to work. And it's like, I don't know, man. Every time I've had to be sexual with a person, there's too much talk going on inside my head about me that I would be so apt to, like, not care what this other person thinks.
Say more on that.
Like, you know... you know, when it's time to get naked with someone, it's not, I'm not ashamed of my body. I think it's fine. But, like, there are insecurities. Like, am I pulling my underwear off weird? Like, you know, do my balls stink today? Like, when was the last time you checked, buddy? Like, you know, how have you, you know, any number of circumstances that, like, you know, I need some tenderness from the person that I'm with to allay some of those concerns that probably never pop up until it's time for me to expose my genitals, right? And as such, I don't... Yeah, I couldn't just whip it out and be like, so, was popping. Yeah, I don't know. I'm just not living life right, I think.
I mean, I think you are. I think I
nailed it. I think I got it pretty good. I ended up with a good one and some very good friends. And I think that that's... even more important, it's not just that I lucked out in the find a mate thing. I also have a group of people around me that I don't think do that either. And I know that the ones close to me don't because I've asked them.
Oh.
Because I go, have you ever done some shit like this? And they go, no. I mean, I've gotten an erection while dancing, but I've never just taken it out. And I was like, good. I'm keeping the same phone number.
Yeah.
Because, oh my God. That is, what a world.
Yeah. So I'm gonna 90 degree it back to the study, but so in this research, one of the other implications of it, one of the research applications of this as well, is that, you know, when we look at these groups of people who, given this information on sexuality being a spectrum, that it is a mixture of genetic predisposition and, like, live experience and what opportunities are available to you and you know, what are the things that you have seen while you were turned on, and, you know, just all the stuff that influences sexual orientation. There are, again, there are more conservative ideologies that basically think these are, like, discrete, hard categories that do not change. And they are then less likely to be supportive of the civil rights of people who are not straight, right? And then there are people who are a little bit more open-minded on all of this stuff in general. They learn this information, like, oh, well, maybe I'm not exclusively straight. I still have my preferences and I have my predilections and what I've done so far. But maybe you know, maybe the future holds something interesting for me. Mm-hmm. And this is also connected to the fact that the biggest predictor of being supportive of the basic human rights of LGBT people is, do you know any of them? So once you start finding yourself being even moved by that, in addition to the fact that you would be more comfortable with other people who are queer, then you also see greater societal acceptance of the civil rights of people who are not exclusively straight.
Or just not exclusively like you. I think, you know, I mean, well, let me not go down that road without the caveat that, yeah, every brother ain't your brother. You can be totally for the liberation of people in sexual realms and then still be a racist. That is, nothing is mutually exclusive.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I think you find, you know, I feel like, yeah, when you find that you are part of a group that has been on the outs in some way, shape, or form, that you typically are in tune with other people who are on the outs and understanding how unfair and ridiculous it is to hold people back for a simple choice, and sometimes not a choice, but like a simple thing being the reason to discriminate. You typically anti-discrimination, but you know, it's not 100%.
No. I mean, there's big problems with racism in the queer community.
Definitely.
You know, there's definitely like anti-trans sentiment even within the LGB population. Yeah, you know, yeah. Obviously there's, you know, lots of people are racial minorities and then have a completely different perspective when it comes to sexuality. Like,
right. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. The world is big and there are a variety of all of your shitty opinions and all of your good ones. You're not even the only one with those, you know. and then when you think about the internet and social media and accounts and puppet accounts and sock puppets and shit like that, like not even everybody who agrees with you on the internet is real or agrees with you. So there's that too. There are some people who are just bad actors and will come and say that they are one of these people and then they believe something the opposite just because they don't really have friends. So, you know, what can you do in the midst of that? Try to live the most genuine life that you fucking can. And, you know, try to help the people you think need help.
Yeah. So, like, in summation on this story, because I think we've covered things like this.
College kids are gay.
Yeah, definitely that. And also just like, I also want to just go around and talk about the Kinsey scale more often, just like randomly to strangers.
Yeah, because man, it's a spectrum.
It might have applications for the world.
If you think you are 100% straight, never thought anything, whatever, and then, you know, I wore tight pants one day and he was like, go ahead, Daryl. You know what's funny? My wife just laughed in the background and it was something different, but it hurt my feelings. Either way, it's totally fine. That's okay. You know what I mean? You don't have to talk to anybody about those feelings. They're totally human. They're totally normal. You know, it's totally okay to feel a way, and you know, the hell, I won't tell anybody. If you want to experiment, go ahead and experiment. But, yeah. You know, just be kind to yourself and others. We're all trying to figure this shit out.
Yeah, and I have empathy for very, like, schematic thinking. Like, yeah. I am a person who's very much about needing discrete categories, like, to the degree, I think part of it's because I'm, like, ADD or whatever, and I've talked about this with, like, autistic friends, where they need things to be very clearly labeled. And they will describe having difficulty with knowing that someone's attracted to them because they need it, like, more directly stated, like the subtle flirty stuff will not be enough to get across, you know. So like, if you are raised in our culture, you've probably heard this, like, you're either gay or you're straight, and then they have opinions on that, or, you know, it's a big deal or it's not, whatever. But still thinking about yourself through one lens and one category for a long time, it can be difficult to break out of that if you are prone to thinking in categories and schemas. And so I was fortunate that as a child, I realized that I was, not even necessarily that I was attracted to, but that people could be attracted to any gender. And it wasn't until later that I heard about those discrete categories. And it was because of that order of operations that I felt very clear on the fact that I was bi early. But I could understand why someone might be bi or pan and just not be registering that, like, no, not everyone looks at the other girls that way. That's not how all girls look at other girls. You know, like that, you know, not everybody looks at their dude friends and thinks like, you know, I'm curious what it would be like to jerk you off. Like, and, and also you can be straight and still also think that, but like, you know,
sure. Everybody needs a hand.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's, I have great empathy for wherever you are. And I hope you're doing what makes you happy.
Right. And you don't have to stay there. If you're unhappy where you are, you can get yourself out of that situation. Sometimes it's very, very hard to get yourself out of that situation. And, you know, have all the sympathy in the world for you. Yeah. Empathy, too. But, you know, hey, the world's big and wide, and you can just move to Australia and go to the University of Sydney and, you know, just become be a three on the scale. Do... do whatever.
You do anything you want. You can go back to Woodstock 99. And for that,
hey,
that's the worst segue I've ever had.
You can go anywhere except to Rome, New York in 1999. No one should have been there.
And you also can't go back to the original Woodstock in 1969.
No, and what you should know is that even at the original Woodstock in 69, there were problems. People died. You know,
there's no use. The military had to airlift in food.
Yeah, yeah. It was, bad things happened then. And then bad things also happened in Woodstock 99, which is the subject of a documentary.
Yes, so that takes us to our next regular... Well, it's still the same segment. It's our next piece of fucking news.
Yeah.
So our next piece of fucking news, this is going to be Daryl and Timmery discuss a movie, which is a fun, we've probably done this before, but it's a newish.
I don't know if we've done it on the podcast, but we've definitely done this when we were prepping for the show.
So I watched the documentary Woodstock 99 and then I had a lot of feelings about it and I told Daryl about it. And so we gave each other the homework that he was going to watch it and he gave me the homework to watch Summer of Soul and I forgot.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I'm going to do that.
It's fine. Many people forgot about the Harlem Cultural Festival.
Yeah. So we're going to talk about Woodstock 99, but yeah, what, okay. Also just like deviate for a second and just what was the Summer of Soul and talk about that, because we also just, I want that context to be how we start talking about this.
Oh yeah. Well, the same year that Woodstock happened, there was the Harlem Cultural Festival. So like over the series of, I don't know, 4 or 5 weekends in New York, in Harlem, there was an outdoor festival that was free to attend. And it was attended by some of the biggest names in music at the time. And there was cameras rolled, footage was taken, and after the festival was done, the person who took the footage tried to sell it to create some kind of a documentary. Nobody wanted it. This was the same year as Woodstock, and this one was black. Go figure. Woodstock was very white. So, you know, same state, much bigger city. There was a festival that was primarily black, and nobody did anything with that footage for 50 years. And then Questlove from the legendary Roots Crew found the footage, I guess, stumbled upon it, punched somebody in the face and ran with it, and created a documentary that interviewed a lot of the acts there, people who were there as children, obviously, because they're still alive. And yeah, it's a really cool movie, and you know, just a real wonderful example of just positivity and love. That even at points, I got a little teary, and my heart is hard. So yeah, it was a cool movie, and I would recommend anybody watch it just because it's a good time, and you get to see Mahalia Jackson sing with Mavis Staples. So, you know,
do yourself a favor.
Do yourself a favor. It's a really, yeah, it's a cool thing. And it just talks about the time, like what New York was like at the time, what it was like being black at the time. And, you know, just, and it's like put together by like a lounge singer kind of dude who like was a musician, but like wasn't super popular. No one would really know who he is. I didn't know who he was. And he put it together, and you know, just how that came took place. And you know, maybe they just didn't cover it in the documentary. But it seems like there was no overflowing porta potties. There was no fetid pools of feces and urine. And there was no sexual assaults and pyromania that took place during the festival. Again, I didn't do any independent research.
Fair enough.
But to get back on track, that's what happened at Woodstock 99.
Yeah, yeah. So watch Summer of Soul, and I'm going to do that as well. But what I did manage to do, and Daryl managed to do, is watch the documentary on Woodstock 99, which is really interesting to watch, really mm-hmm. well produced as far as things go. It also brought up a lot of topics that are relevant to the show. And some of the things, you know, Daryl's already touched on, which are the fact that this, like, this event was put on by some of the same dudes who put on the original Woodstock in 69, which was...
And 94.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Which I had completely forgotten existed. But the original Woodstock has this, like, cachet around it that makes it seem like it was just sweetness and love, and it was just, like, 3 days of just, like, magic in the middle of, like, a very turbulent time. But actually, it was a fairly poorly run event, and there were lots of problems about it, and we just don't remember it that way because we weren't there.
Right. And so, they don't sell it that way.
No. And everything that the boomers do was the most and the best and the time that, you know, mattered. And so they try to recreate that in Woodstock 99. It's some of the same dudes, definitely at least one or two of the same dudes that were involved in the original one. And when they attempt to recreate Woodstock 69 in 99, they do so in a very specific way. And it is heavily, heavily, heavily marketed to white men. There are literally only 3 women musical acts. I can literally name them. They are Sheryl Crow, Alanis Morissette, and Jewel. Mm-hmm. And they were not on any of the same days. They were separated. This is a 4-day long festival, and they kept the women artists on separate days. So it seems kind of intentional.
Oh, and what was great was when the dude was like, "We didn't keep any kind of metric on how many women. We just whoever we thought could make it, we brought. That's it." And I just love that the when the counter to, "Hey, it really seems like there are some biases in your programming," is like, "We weren't biased. We were just looking for talent." Okay, so are you saying that talent skews 90% white and male? Is that that's your opinion in music?
Yeah, that's a hot take, especially that's, in music.
In music, that's word. Okay, all right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like you had Limp Bizkit on.
Yeah. And, like, you'd be hard-pressed to find somebody nowadays who'd be like, "Oh, yes, the cultural impacts of Limp Bizkit." And,
oh, I was there in the middle of it. I saw it.
I mean, so, okay, I had a whole lot of different reactions to this documentary because, first of all, it's very well done. It mm-hmm. discusses many of the problems. It discusses this lack of women representation in the artists. It discussed the logistical problems with the festival itself. There's like poop everywhere and like $4 bottles of water and you know, like just chaos and then eventually there's like fires and just burning things and it's just,
at least,
you know, like
they waited till the last night to set the fires, you know.
Yeah, which great.
And it started out as a vigil for Columbine, so look,
which is the irony,
everything starts with peace. You know, it's just, we wanted to
candles.
Commemorate the lives lost.
The anti-gun group gave out candles that got used to burn shit down is the fucking entire summary of Woodstock 99.
It's America, baby.
And it was also really problematic in terms of, like, this was, you know, if you were alive in the late 90s, you remember that, like, women's place is very much like you gotta be a female chauvinist pig or you're like button up, right? Like, you are flashing your titties for Girls Gone Wild or else you are a square. I remember being a young person in that time, and that was very much the options afforded to me. And so I was very much reared in that internalized misogyny culture of, like, if dudes do it and it is pleasing to men, then it's cool. You know, very much raised in that. And as a person who was, like, very interested in sexual liberation, that was the only path I saw to that because, like, second wave feminism had told me, you know, porn is bad. You know, sex is only for, like, you know, being used and exploited and da da da. So the only pathway forward at that time was you can either flash your titties for a screaming crowd, or you don't get to fuck. You know, so I had a lot of feelings about that because, like, obviously there's more to it. I also had a hard time thinking about the fact that, like, the music that I still love, like, I still listen to some Rage Against the Machine. I still listen to, you know, some of this 90s stuff. Although Rage, I think, would be
musically they were different. I don't know.
Musically and politically far different than, like,
far different, yeah. Limp, I mean, biscuit. You know, Metallica was there, Rage yes. was there, yeah. fucking Moby was there, like,
Moby,
you know,
there was there.
There was a variety of people, and some of that music lasts and some of it doesn't, you know. I got into Korn, but it was like end of 99, 2000. Mm. So, yeah, like those were my Korn years. You know.
And the documentary is not without its failings. Like, on one level, first of all, it's describing the, like, this toxic masculinity of the late 90s where they're like, how did we start a decade with, like, Kurt Cobain in a dress and we end up with, you know, Fred Durst telling people to break stuff? And there's, you know, there's a lot more complexity to it than that. And also, they fail to mention that, like, Jonathan Davis of Korn performed at Woodstock 99 in a dress. Like, they just don't mention that.
That's also right? true. And
so Korn is mentioned as one of these sort of, like, you know, really aggro acts, but Jonathan Davis would be not describable as, like...
And he's actually in the documentary saying that he would tell people to beat up abusers in the crowd. Like...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's also... there was, I think, a moment with Offspring. Offspring also took time to say on the mic, like, if a girl is trying to, like, ride the wave through the mosh pit, you don't get to just grab at her. She's just trying to, like,
have
you
fun.
Know, crowd surf. Like, so there were, you know, there's the examples of all the assaults that were happening, which is, you know, unequivocally awful. Right. But there were also examples of people who were trying to push back against that, even at that time.
I had to clutch my pearls when they had one of the promoter dudes interviewed, and they were like,
"It was John Scher.
What do you have to say about all the sexual assaults?" And he was like, "Well, these women had their tops out for days in a row." And I was like, "How is this sentence going to end?" And it ended exactly like you thought it would. He really tried to blame women for being sexually assaulted. It's refreshing to see that kind of victim blaming happening. You know, you don't see it a lot. And to some, they would say you don't see it enough. You know what those people aren't? Victims.
I mean, it's literally one of the main organizers. His argument was, well, all these women were walking around being, like, in body paints. You know, what did they think was going to happen? He also tried to say that there were only, like, two or three that were reported. But, like, one thing that we know about sexual assault is that most of the time it doesn't get reported because you don't want to have to go through that. You don't think anyone will believe you. They'll ask you a bunch of intrusive questions that
and
make
they'll
it
say dumbass shit like you were wearing body paint.
Yeah, and then nothing will ever come of it because they can't even be bothered to, like, you know...
take you seriously.
Yeah, they don't solve most murders, you know, like, so imagine them trying to... whatever. Yeah, so this guy's trying to be like, there's only like two or three or whatever. A group of women who had attended Woodstock 99 started an online forum that was like, did something happen to you? Did you go to Woodstock 99? Did something happen to you that was violating? Do you want to talk to anybody about it? Do you want to be connected with resources? Do you want to share with other people who are there who will be supportive? And they got a ton. They got a ton of responses, and from people who were minors.
In the three figures.
Yeah. And I think that's a statement on sexual assault in, you know, weird, transient, party-ish places in general.
Right.
I mean, this is sexual assaults on campus are a problem for the same reason. There's a lot of people coming and going. There's a lot of drinking. There's a lot of chaos.
Yeah, at raves. That's another issue. Just the drug use and the, people... are not in their right minds. And not to say I wasn't in my right mind, so I committed this assault and I don't know what I was doing, just people weren't in their right minds to be able to fight off in advance, and there were going to be people who were going to be predatory in providing drugs for that atmosphere. You know, you don't have to run, you don't have to be the main actor on the Cosby Show to know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
There was a 24-hour rave going on in Woodstock. That was the other part that I was like, nobody really talked about that, because that, I know, oh boy. It was like they just had DJs all night playing music in case you didn't feel like sleep was a thing in 90-degree heat.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like, on a strictly, like, human level, like, people were dying of lots of things, especially hypernatremia, drinking too much water, to combat the fact that it was, like, incredibly hot. There were a number of people who died from just heat exhaustion. These are young people.
Yeah.
And there were individuals who were stone sober.
Right.
You know, isn't.
Yeah.
This isn't even like you do too much Molly, you forget to drink water. Like this is, this is people who just didn't have access to water. We're like in these hot crowds. It's like the middle of the summer, like
on asphalt in the middle of the summer on asphalt. Dancing in a crowd of people who are sweaty and smell bad too. That's got
to
be one of the
things. Oh, they have to.
Would kill you. But yeah, it's like they would die of heat exhaustion. And heat exhaustion don't just kill you immediately.
Mm.
It's not like getting struck by lightning. It is a slow, often painful death. And it happened a lot. And, you know, you can't control for everything. But I would think if you were going to if I threw a party at my house in the summertime, I'm trying to make sure people have enough water that they don't die of heat exhaustion.
Yeah. I mean, that's honestly one of the takeaways I had from watching this is, like, I'm never going to a music festival again. And, like, because the last time I went to one was just, like, a perfectly cromulent music festival. But, like, they wouldn't let me bring water in, right? Yeah. Like, they wouldn't let me bring, like, an apple in. But if I go in there, it's not like I can buy an apple on the other side. They're just like trying to make money, right? And then like
they do water that at the bottles. Movies too.
Yeah, and like you can bring like you can bring your Nalgene or whatever, but it has to be empty. Mm-hmm. And then if you want water, you have to go wait in a 45-minute long line to refill it. And of course, it's cheaper to just go buy alcohol.
Yeah.
And so as a young person, you're doing your like, do I really want to spend 45 minutes at this festival like waiting in line to fill up for water?
Right.
And then I have to figure out where I'm going to pee? Or do I just get fucking hammered and then I'll pee where I want cuz I'm drunk and I won't care? Like And that's a statement on like how much do they give a shit about the people who are there? And this would be an example of people who did not care. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I mean, just they at the end they say how Coachella was so different because they probably in the aftermath of Woodstock 99, that was the first Coachella festival, and like they gave everybody water at the front, and they you know, it was in Palm Springs on a balmy day, and you know, there was greenery around, and you know, they tried to be a little bit better than the absolute horse shit show that fucking Woodstock was. But yeah, I was never a big music guy, like live music. I never.
It's not how you like to consume it.
Nah, I mean, I would be at home listening to DJs play sets at like the Tunnel when I was in high school and stuff, and it seemed like that would be cool. But then the music I was listening to was all about how I always carry a gun, and if anybody doesn't think I'm cool, I'll shoot them. And I was like, I don't think I need to go see that live. I don't. I feel like this is just a bunch of gangsters loudly promoting how murderous they are. And you know, I like rap music. I like when things rhyme. I like a clever lyric, or perhaps a punchline or two. Not a fan of gunplay. So, you know, but that's me. I, it exists on a spectrum. Who knows? Maybe tomorrow I'll love gunplay, but I try to keep that in my Fallout universe.
Yeah, I'm also not that guy. Like, my ideal way to consume music is like while dancing, which is not fun to do in a very tightly packed space. Right. So, like, I've been to many a concert. Do not get me wrong. My ideal way of being at a concert is being hired to be a dancer on the stage.
Well, Yeah,
because sure. then I have space.
And because you're getting paid, someone is responsible for your safety.
I mean, yes, also
pay to get in yeah. there, right? Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I get that. I get that. Like, I mean,
I'll go to a club and I'll dance before everyone else starts dancing when they're still sober. That's my wheelhouse. Is like no one else is on the dance floor. That's where I'm having my best life. And you know, everyone is like, this girl is weird, and I'm getting a lot of projection and judgment. And I have done it long enough that I know that it's really not about me.
No,
so really I should just have fun, because they're all going to get drunk enough to come out here in a little bit, and yeah. then I'm going to want to go because it's yeah. too packed.
Yeah, because they're going to do it barefoot and drop a glass on the floor. Oh, yeah. There's a magical, I don't know, there's a magical 30 minutes after every DTF when the dance party starts.
Yeah,
but. The throngs, the wistless, starved for attention throngs of people have yet to invade the dance floor, and it's just the people who came to see DTF.
Yeah.
Who like dance a little bit, and those are good times.
That's man, you're making me horny for fun. You know? Yeah.
Well. Yeah. Happens.
So that's I feel like that's a good enough spot. Like, y'all should watch the documentary, and then you should also watch Summer of Soul, and then send us your thoughts on that. And we'll be back in the physical space at some point. We don't have a date yet because everything is sort of up in the air right now, but we are in conversation.
Get vaccinated. Venue. That's the easiest. Do you want to know when DTF is coming next? Get vaccinated. Tell your dumbass cousins who don't get vaccinated that they should get vaccinated, and tell them that Daryl said, stop being afraid of needles, you fucking baby, and go and get the shot. You don't care about your life, or else you wouldn't be eating the food that you eat. You don't grow your food. You are nowhere near a vegetarian. Stop being precious about nonsense. I'm sorry that you're not smart enough to understand that the scientists have rigor and aren't sitting here trying to kill you. I'm sorry that that seems like a foreign concept to you. Maybe active aggression and passive aggression will work. We'll know when we're doing a live DTF when people aren't being absolute jackasses in the street.
I mean, I'm excited that, like, as of this recording today, Pfizer's shot got FDA approval, so the argument that it's not FDA approved, you can't make that at one anymore.
Hey.
And there are lots of places that are starting to do vaccine mandates as a result of that, yes. because now that it's FDA approved, you can mandate that. And if somebody was holding out, they can now go get it and be like, well, I was forced to, you know, I didn't change my mind. I'm still an independent thinker.
Right.
So hopefully just like we all come together and realize that this is a collective problem.
Look, if I get not trusting the government, I get not trusting Big Pharma, and I'm not saying that any of these people have scruples, but what I will tell you is that they are rigorous in their standards. That is the thing that kind of blows that away for me. It's like, I'm not saying that these people necessarily care about your life. I'm saying that they do not want to get sued when people die en masse. And so at the very least, they're going to do all the paperwork it takes to get that shit done. And that bureaucracy is government standing up for the lives of its citizens. And, you know, tear it all down. We can fucking go socialist tomorrow. You can bet that fucking Moderna is not trying to kill you with a shot. They would rather kill you with corn that grows once and then doesn't grow again unless you buy Moderna fertilizer. That's how that they would rather you die from that. That's something that they could easily make money off of.
All right, well, that's been another episode of DTF where every single time it turns out capitalism was the villain all along.
But here, capitalism is the hero, right? Like, sure, there's plenty of things to distrust, but here's one thing capitalism is going to do. It's not going to kill its citizens en masse for no good fucking reason. There's got to be money involved, and there's way more money in the economy opening back up than there is in, ooh, we made them take a secret serum. That's so, nobody is Skeletor. Anyway. It's more a Serpentor thing, but still, you wow. catch my drift.
Yeah, wow. A nod to the fandom.
Cobra, la 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 la.
All right. Well, in the meantime, while we're waiting to get back into our venue, where can people find out more about you and buy their Black Gentrifier merch?
You can get Black Gentrifier merch on the internet at tpublic.com/DarylComedy. You can go to darylcomedy.com for a link there and a link to all the other things I do. I have my calendar, which will see me in Philadelphia, New York, Baltimore, St. Louis, and Hanover, Pennsylvania soon. So, you know, I'm doing all the things. I'm out here in these streets. I'm vaccinated and I am staying away from people. So come out. Be one of those people that I have to actively stay away from. I appreciate it. And yeah, where can people find you, Dr. Timmery?
Oh, that's a great question. You can find out a lot about me on drtimmery.com. I will be posting in the blog a variety of links to news articles, including the things that we discussed on the show. I will also be posting my events. I've got a bunch of stuff coming up soon. We've got a mixture of Slut Church related things, including there's going to be a top secret party that will be September 24th, and you want to get the tickets for that in advance because you will find out the address if you buy tickets in advance. So that will be a good idea. And we also have, this is going to be the first time I've announced this, actually, Get You a Babe Who Could Do Both is coming back. We have a date October 3rd at Frankie Bradley's.
Ooh.
So Get You a Babe Who Could Do Both is the show that is a mixture of TED Talks and burlesque by the same people. So I'm currently casting. The show will be October 3rd. We'll have a ticket link up for you soon. But that will be phenomenal to be back in person for that. So if you...
That's always a good time too.
Yeah. If you like learning stuff and then getting turned on and being like, you know what? I don't have to choose between that. This is the show.
All right. I want to hear about distributed ledger technology and also see that performer naked.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, I know who you're talking about.
Those were thoughts that I had.
Yeah. So all that will be at Dr. Timmery, that's D-R, T-I-M-A-R-E-E.com. And we will let you know as soon as we're able to go back to the shows. But in the meantime, we'll keep doing this.
Mm-hmm. Stay safe.
Yeah. Yeah. So thank you to our editor, our producer, Flirt Vonnegut. And thank you for listening. Thank you for supporting us.
Thank you so much.
We will talk at you next week.
Bye-bye.
And you ain't hanging with the team if you ain't down to fuck.